E-A-L.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to Ask a Vegan. Today is September 16th, 2012, and it's time to talk about my favorite subject, food, and so many other things that are related to the food that we eat. And it's cooling down here in New York City. It's really lovely these last few days as we're ending summer and getting into fall. This is probably my favorite time of year. We have some great breezes, and yet the sun is still out, and it's clear, fresh. It's lovely. But while it's cooling down here in New York, things are heating up probably all over the world. There's a lot of terrible things we're hearing about in the news, all kinds of violence and rebellions, and it's a very interesting time, and I can only hope that good things come out of all the activity that's going on. But there's only really so much that we can do about things going on around the world. Certainly we can put out positive feelings of hope and love and encouragement to support those that are fighting for the things that they believe in. But we can certainly fight for the things that we believe in here at home, and do that by supporting companies we believe in, by purchasing their products, not purchasing the products of companies we don't believe in, writing our legislatures, writing our congresspeople, and getting our voice out there, getting heard, talking with our friends and family about what's important to us in a loving and non-judgmental way, of course. There's nothing more frustrating than listening to someone who's red in the face and raging about a particular issue. Even if that person is right, when we're filled with so much emotion and so much anger, the information that we want to get across really does not come out. Anger is not always the best vehicle to transmit information. Information, I believe, is best transmitted on a platform of love, on a positive platform, when we're at peace with ourselves and want to make change with everything that's all around us. Keep that in mind. I think it'll make a difference in getting your point across. Okay, so there's lots of different things going on in the news, as I've mentioned, and so much of it just seems so ridiculous and crazy, and yet it has such tremendous impact on everything in our lives. So pink slime is back in the news. You've probably heard that. We talked about pink slime when it came out in the news from a program on ABC and their campaign for a month about pink slime, which is really lean, finely textured beef, LFTB. It's funny because there are different names for everything, and some of them give you an impression that is good, and some of you give an impression that is bad. What's in a name? Lean, finely textured beef sounds pleasant. It sounds friendly. But when you go into the actual process of how it's made, it may not sound as friendly and appealing to you. Ergo, the name pink slime. My point when I talked about it when it first came out in the news in March was not that this was a good or bad product. It was more about how people don't know what's in their food. For the most part, people don't care about what's in their food. They just want it cheap, and they want it a lot, and they want it convenient. And then when a media outlet, ABC News as an example, decides to pick up on one particular step in one particular process of one particular food out of hundreds of thousands of different products that are out there on the market, and they decide to do a show about it, there's all of this media that reacted as a result, and people reacted because, you know, we're like that. We see something, we hear about it, and everybody gets all emotional about it together, and we react. In some ways, that's a good thing. It's good that people are getting focused about manufactured food, processed food, and not wanting it for themselves, and certainly not wanting it for their children, and not wanting it in the schools. But There are so many foods out there today that people are eating that are highly processed. And if people knew the steps that went into every food that they ate, things would dramatically change. I think people might not go vegetarian, but people certainly would stay away from more processed foods if they could see how foods were made. Okay, so pink slime is in the news because the company that was the target, the company that makes the lean, finely textured beef, LFTB, BPI, and BPI stands for Beef Products Incorporated, Beef Products Incorporated Technology, Inc., and Freezing Machines. It's collectively known as BPI. Well, they filed a lawsuit just a few days ago on September 13th against ABC in circuit court in Union County, South Dakota. Now, South Dakota is important. Why they chose South Dakota? For knowingly and intentionally publishing false and disparaging statements regarding BPI and LFTB, lean, finely textured beef, and improperly interfering with BPI business relationships. BPI alleges ABC knowingly and intentionally published false and disparaging statements regarding BPI and LFTB. Statements made by ABC were inconsistent with information BPI and others provided to them and were contradicted by the findings of the USDA, FDA, food safety organizations, and numerous beef industry experts. ABC either knew it, was making false statements about BPI and LFTB, or acted with reckless disregard for the truth. BPI filed suit because their business has been severely damaged by ABC's action. Okay, very interesting. And there's lots of very interesting things about this particular suit. BPI is asking for compensatory and statutory damages for defamation, product and food disparagement, and improper interference with business relationships in a sum exceeding $1 billion plus punitive damages. Now, BPI is doing a massive campaign to show that their lean, finely textured beef is a lovely, healthy, nutritious, sustainable, and economical product. They have a website called beefisbeef.com. Now, if I was going to come up with a similar website, I would call it beefiscow.com, because beef is just one of those words that separates us one more step from that sentient being, that precious, innocent animal that in most factory farms today is crammed into filthy, dense, horrific conditions, fed horrible food, and is then sent off to a terrible nightmare of slaughter before she is packaged and served on plates in schools and in restaurants and in your home. And then what BPI and other companies try and do is use every piece of that animal so that they can profit from it and make the whole experience as profitable as possible. So they take some of that fat from the animal, and with ammonium hydroxide, they have a process to get the protein out of it, and it's something that they call lean, finely textured beef, and they add that back into some of their meat products. They have a lovely poster that you can find on the beefisbeef.com website where they give you the facts about LFTB. They say it is safe, lean, nutritious, sustainable, and economical. Isn't that lovely? And they say that it's always been safe. In more than 20 years, there has not been a single reported case of foodborne illness caused by BPI's LFTB. And they say it's lean, 94% to 97% lean, nutritious, made from muscle meat. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally don't think any kind of meat is nutritious, and it comes with all kinds of things that I personally don't want in my body, but they're promoting it as nutritious. And here's my favorite. They say that it's sustainable. BPI's process captures an additional 10 to 20 pounds of lean beef from each animal, decreasing the need for additional cattle to be slaughtered for U.S. lean beef demand and decreasing the cost of lean ground beef for consumers. Isn't that nice that they are saving the lives of additional cattle to be slaughtered, and that it's more sustainable because it's subtle here. You have to read between the lines, but they're acknowledging that growing more animals to feed people is not sustainable because the whole process isn't sustainable. Whether we're growing, I don't know how many cattle off the top of my head we're growing in this country, but several billion cattle versus a few more, it's devastating on the environment no matter what we do. What needs to happen today in this country and outside of the United States is people need to be eating less animal, not more, and we need to be eating plants, organic plants, biodynamically grown, organic, sustainably farmed plant food. People need to be educated more and more about this. And when people read about pink slime, lean, fine textured beef, their response should be, what's going on in the meat industry on the whole, not just what's being reported by ABC? What's going on? I want to know more about it, and I don't want to eat this food, and I don't want my family eating it. That's what should be the response. But BPI is fighting back, and they have this lawsuit against ABC. And it reminded me of a lot of history that's gone on over the years to get us to where we are today. There's an article by the Civil Liberties Defense Center that was put out in January of this year, and I will post the link to this article because it's an interesting one to know about. And it's about the veggie libel laws, attempts at silencing animal rights advocates. You know, what's going on today with BPA and ABC is really about profit, but there's more to it that can really hurt us or help us in terms of activism and in terms of telling the truth and in getting wholesome products out versus products that are suspect and not good for us, not good for children, not good for the environment, and certainly not good for the animals. So this particular article put out by the Civil Liberties Defense Center, they talk about how it all got started. Back in 1964 in New York Times versus Sullivan, the United States Supreme Court held that the First Amendment protects individuals who make defamatory statements related to matters of public concern, so long as such statements are not made with actual malicious or in reckless disregard of the truth. Okay, that sounds pretty good. So basically, back in 1964, the Supreme Court gave more support with the First Amendment, saying that we are protected if we are speaking the truth and we're not purposely trying to be reckless or malicious. But again, there's some interpretation that can be applied to that, as with many, many things. 40 years later, things have really changed, and it's due to major meat, dairy, and agricultural lobbyists. Lobbyists, gotta love those lobbyists. Because more states have been adopting food disparagement laws, which are designed to make it easier for food producers to hold individuals liable for criticizing their products. That just, when these things started to come out, it was just incredible. So people in some states have to really be careful if they're going to criticize a food product because they can be sued. And part of that problem is that individuals, for the most part, don't have the finances to protect themselves in a lawsuit if they were sued. Whereas many of these food producers are big, giant companies with lots of fancy lawyers and a big budget to protect themselves. So they wanted to have these laws in place so that they would have the ability to sue, but more so that they would scare people and prevent them from doing the work that needs to be done because people would know that they could be sued and couldn't afford to be sued. So the 13 states that have enacted food disparagement laws are Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Texas. And if you are from any of these states, I would encourage you to write your congresspeople and talk to them and work to get these food disparagement laws off the books, certainly in your own state. How did these things come out? How did they come to be? And I think the story is kind of interesting. It started with apples. And then the animal industries kind of got involved. So the apple industry, what happened was there was a chemical called Alar, which was sprayed on apples. It was known to regulate and enhance their growth and color. And then CBS in 1989 aired a 60 Minutes episode. Do you remember when these shows really made a difference? I do. They would come out with these really great shows and everybody would be horrified to find out what was happening, and things would change. Now we've all kind of become numb to it to some extent until this pink slime thing came out about a month ago. We've got to stay on top of everything and know where our food comes all the time. It's hard work, I know, but it needs to be done. We really can't trust anyone. So back in 1989, CBS aired on 60 Minutes a program called A is for Apple. Personally, I don't remember it. I don't know if I even watched it, and I don't remember when it came out in the news, but reading about it is kind of interesting. They reported that children were especially at risk because they absorb and retain more of what they eat than adults per unit of body weight of this particular chemical that was put on apples. And millions of people watched the episode, and you guessed it, a widespread panic followed. School districts took apples from school cafeterias. Grocery stores removed them from the shelves. Meryl Streep got involved and testified to Congress about the dangers of Alar. And as a result, unfortunately, apple orchard growers lost millions of dollars. And Uniroyal, who made Alar, was forced to stop selling the chemical. I think that's a good thing. The EPA also banned Alar because of, quote, probable human carcinogens. It's interesting because there are many chemicals out on the market, many chemicals that are used on our food that are approved by the EPA that are probable human carcinogens. But until there's a major outcry against them, until there are more studies and reports and education put out there, they're just going to be used. Another thing is that some of the chemicals that are banned in the United States are used in other countries, and then their products are imported, and we use them, unless we're making a conscious effort to know where our food comes from, and we're buying only organic certified, or buying from farmers that we know do not use toxic pesticides and herbicides. It's a lot of work. It's hard, but it's important. It is so important. Okay, so this apple thing was catastrophic to the apple industry. And what happened? Lawsuit. A group of Washington state apple growers filed a $250 million suit. Now that's cheap in today's dollars, against CBS. And they said that 60 Minutes had falsely disparaged their products. They lost that suit. But as a result, the industry got smart, and they thought, we can't let this happen again. Well, it wasn't the apple industry that really got smart. It was the meat and dairy industry. So in 1992, a couple of years after this lawsuit, the American Feed Industry Association, a lobbying group for the multi-billion dollar cattle feed and pet food industries, hired a Washington, D.C. law firm to draft model legislation to provide more protection for their economic interests. And they moved to get major changes in our law, and 13 states adopted forms of legislation on their own, despite federal warnings. And they are currently on the books. So, three constitutionally suspect provisions are common to all of these state laws. They eliminate or replace the actual malice, reckless disregard standard articulated in the New York Times Company versus Sullivan with a weaker negligence standard, meaning that the business need only prove the defendant was negligent in making false or disparaging statements. Okay, so now the burden of proof is on the defendant, the plaintiff being the food industry, who's trying to protect itself from being attacked from people that are criticizing their product. Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Now the innocent need to prove that they were negligent or they were not negligent in making false or disparaging statements. And this is really, really scary. And again, as I mentioned before, one of the reasons these laws were put on the books was, of course, to protect the companies that have products to sell. And they don't want people criticizing them because then they'll get bad press and they will lose consumers and they will lose sales. But the other product, the other reason is to scare. It is to scare us and prevent us from criticizing things that we know are wrong. And this kind of came to a head back in the mid-90s when Howard Lyman, a whistleblowing former cattle rancher, was on Oprah Winfrey. Do you remember that? I remember it because Howard Lyman was president of EarthSave International during the time I was on the board of EarthSave. And it was a few years after this lawsuit began, and I knew him during the years when it was still going on and when it was finally decided that he had done no wrong. He had spoken the truth, and he was cleared, unfortunately. He said, and he's been quoted many times because he has, in talking about those that sued him, he has said, apparently they believe that the First Amendment was not meant to be interpreted so broadly as to allow people to say unpleasant things about beef. And a funny thing can happen when you tell the truth in this country. You can get sued. And that's what these veggie libel laws, these food disparagement laws, are all about. When you tell the truth, you have the risk of getting sued. How does that sound to you? Now, this Oprah Winfrey show, Howard Lyman talked about how he knew firsthand, because he had been a former cattle rancher, and he knew that cattle were being fed to cattle. Cows were being fed to cows, and this could spread mad cow disease. Mad cow disease was in the news quite a bit back then because there had been this outbreak in Great Britain and everyone was hysterical about this horrific disease from eating cows. I took advantage of it when I visited Great Britain because a lot of the pubs started offering veggie burgers and other vegetarian items on their menus, which was great because more people were eating less meat because they were afraid of mad cow disease. What always intrigued me was why people weren't afraid of heart disease and why people weren't afraid of all the other chronic diseases that they could get from eating meat. But apparently mad cow disease got a lot more scary press than heart attacks. Heart attacks, of course, affect over 600,000 people a year in the United States, and they are preventable and reversible. But mad cow disease seemed exceptionally scary because it seemed to happen quickly, and the description of it, the way it ate away at our brains, was something that people found more upsetting, I guess, than getting a heart attack and relying on doctors to rip open their sternum and put in a stent. I don't understand anything. But back to the Oprah Winfrey case. Howard Lyman explained the process of how cows would be rendered and fed back to cattle. And as you know, cows are vegetarian. They're supposed to eat green grass. And unfortunately today, the cows that are raised for beef are fed, for the most part, all kinds of things that they shouldn't be eating, things that really upset their gut. And there's a lot of inflammation and infection as a result. It's a very cruel and unhealthy and unsustainable process. And so he talked about it a bit on Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah, as a response, said that she would never eat another burger. And the price of meat went down that week, and the Texas Beef Group sued as a result. So now we have all of these veggie libel laws that are in the books of 13 states. And it is a kind of a scary thing, because we know there are a lot of things that are going on that are wrong. If people say that if factory farms had glass walls, for example, more people would be vegetarian if they would see what was going on inside. I think if more people saw how chicken nuggets were made, how hot dogs were made, I think they would think twice before grabbing one for lunch. We need to know. But, you know, if we don't take the time to know, if we don't take the responsibility, well, maybe we deserve to eat the food that we choose to eat. I don't know. What do you think? I think our food should be healthy. I think there's a lot of requirements that should be instituted in our food system in order to keep our environment safe, in order to protect animals and protect people and protect the planet. And we can do it all deliciously and economically. It's not expensive, and nobody's going to be deprived. Just look at the recipes that I keep posting at responsibleeatingandliving.com. We've got over 160 of them, and they're all fabulous. And there are so many different vegan cookbooks that are out on the market. You don't have to be deprived. You can have so many variations, so many different kinds of dishes. It's just endless, infinite, and wonderful. All right, so there's a Harvard website, harvard.edu, puts out a variety of different health articles at their hsph.harvard.edu site. And there is a discussion about the obesity prevention source, genes are not destiny. Again, I'll include this link on this podcast post so you can read more about it. But genes are getting a lot of press in the news. And it's just like so many things. It's a good thing. It's not such a good thing. We are learning so much about nutrition, about the human body. And we really know so little. You know, we know so much more than we knew before. But it's just the tip of the iceberg. And in some ways it can be helpful. But I think in more ways it can be very dangerous. And we're learning about genes, and we're making all kinds of assumptions. And many of them are not true. Some of them are helpful, but some of them aren't. And there's a couple of things that bother me about all the things that we're talking about with respect to genes. And I mean genes in our chromosomes, G-E-N-E-S genes, not our blue genes. That's a whole other subject. Our American-style blue jeans, most of them which are made outside of the United States, outsourced so that they can be cheap and no longer made in the USA. And the jeans, the G-E-A-N-S jeans that are made in the United States, no one can afford. It's such a sad picture. But back to G-E-N-E-S jeans in our chromosomes. Two problems. One is, some people think that if they have a certain gene that creates a certain condition or characteristic, like more likelihood of being obese, they think that they don't have responsibility and they shouldn't try to make changes in their life and they shouldn't try to improve their situation. This is dangerous because I do not believe for the most part that genes mean we no longer have control. We absolutely do have control when it comes to our health and wellness. And if we learn that we have an obesity gene, for example, that does not mean we have to be obese. We can take charge and we can make a difference in our lives. So in some ways, people take this information about genes and use it as an excuse, as a way out. And I think it's very sad, and I think it's very misleading. The other thing about genes is that it may cause people to have unnecessary surgery because they may have a risk of achieving some kind of disease. And that's really scary to me. So many people undergoing unnecessary surgery because they've learned that they have an increased risk for something. I'll be talking more about genes this Wednesday on my It's All About Food show. I'm really excited. I have Dr. Robert Klitzman coming on. He's the author of Am I My Genes? I've just finished reading that book, and it's really fascinating. And I'll be talking more about that with him on Wednesday, and I hope you'll join me. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Tuesday. My show just moved to Tuesday. So it's going to be on Tuesday from 4 to 5 Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I hope you will join me. It's going to be a really interesting show. And I think the studies that harvard.edu site discusses, the implication is genes are not destiny, and I'm glad that they say that. The other issue about genes, and this is just something that really fascinates me. Think about this. Our genes in our chromosomes were formed in our grandmother's bodies, our maternal grandmother's bodies. Actually, both. But when our mother was conceived and growing in our grandmother's womb, our mother's eggs were formed. And those eggs were the ones that some of them became us, the future children. They were formed inside our mother, inside our grandmother's womb. Isn't that fascinating? And there are more studies that are showing that things that happen to us in our lives today have been affected by things that were going on in our grandmother's womb. Crazy. Now, some of the more dangerous things are the chemicals that are in our environment today will affect future generations. So if our grandmother was exposed to toxic chemicals through pesticides and herbicides, or furniture and paint coatings, all kinds of things, plastics and materials, or just working in a factory or living near a farm, those chemicals may have affected her unborn children and their eggs in the female unborn children that ultimately affect her unborn children. The grandchildren. It's complicated. It's fascinating. And this is why it's so important that we think ahead when we do things, because so many of our choices today affect future generations in so many unforeseen ways. And many of the genes that are being formed in mothers' bodies while they're in their mothers' wombs affect future generations. Crazy stuff. And we're certainly going to be learning more and more about that. So much for our genes. Now, last week, I don't think I had a chance to mention this, but there was in the New York Times an article by Nicholas Kristof called When Happy Cows Produce Happy Milk. Did you read it? There were a lot of responses to this article, and I was really upset by it because it was another example of people pulling the wool over their eyes, pun intended. The article basically was talking about this one particular farmer, Bob, who grows organic milk and or who has an organic milk product by growing cows that are fed organically and are treated, according to Nicholas Kristof, quote, humanely. It was pretty upsetting, the article, because there were so many different factors that Warren brought up. Now, something that I really appreciated is so many people in the response to this article online brought up these really important issues. The title, of course, When Happy Cows Produce Happy Milk. There was no mention about the babies, the calves that were born to these cows, because, of course, a cow cannot give milk unless she is made pregnant. And let's remind ourselves, for those of us who are consuming dairy, that there is cruelty involved and there is slaughter and death involved. The babies, most of the babies from these cows are taken to veal manufacturers, and they are crammed into these tiny stalls where they can't move, and they're fed some iron poor product so that their meat stays white and pink, and they don't live very long, and they're very frail, and it's a miserable, miserable environment. They're taken away from their mothers almost immediately in many cases, if not a few days later. The mother is upset and tortured. The baby is treated horribly. And none of this was mentioned in the When Happy Cows Produce Happy Milk article. Big void. And of course, the farmer, Bob, did mention that it's heartbreaking to him when these cows stop giving the amount of milk that they normally give. And his favorite cows, he tries to send off to a happier end of life where they get to chomp grass and have steers suckle on them and not get slaughtered and put into hamburger, which is really the destiny of most dairy cows, even the ones on organic farms. So this was a really upsetting article and just another example of how people really do not want to see the truth. I will be talking to John Robbins later in the month. I think it's September 25th. You'll have to check the responsibleeatingandliving.com website, but he recently put out a book called No Happy Cows. So we'll be talking more about cows and a lot of cruelty that goes on in the world on my It's All About Food show, which again is on Tuesdays now from 4 to 5 p.m. And it is holiday time. I love the holidays. You know I love the holidays. And as I've said many, many times, I am an atheist-leaning agnostic. I am not a religious person. I was raised in the Jewish faith, and therefore I'm very familiar with Jewish holidays, and I love holiday foods. My partner Gary was raised in the Catholic faith, and he loves all the Christian holidays, and so together we make all kinds of veganized versions of holiday foods, and that's how we celebrate, with the fun foods. Now, the Jewish New Year is coming up. Today is Erev Rosh Hashanah, the New Year's Eve, although it's not filled with noisemakers and boisterous partying, but there is some good food involved. And the point is to start the year off as a sweet year, and to do that, it's with sweet food. And one of the traditions is to dip apples in honey. What we do is dip apples in agave. Equally sweet, equally good, no cruelty involved. And the couple of recipes that I like to make are my sweeter than honey cake, which is a spice cake, based on the traditional honey cake recipe. And there's always challah bread, which is the egg bread, which I now make. Eggless, of course. I've talked a bit about how I make that bread. I'm continually reworking the recipe and figuring out how to make it better because I'm now making many of my challah breads gluten-free. And that adds another level of challenge to it. But I hope you'll visit my challah bread recipe. It's dynamic. That means when I find out something that will make it better, I update the recipe. So if you've seen it a while ago, you might want to check it again. And I did the same thing with my honey cake. I came out with a vegan honey cake recipe a couple of years ago, and then I made a gluten-free version of it last year, and I've posted them both. And yesterday I was doing a lot of baking, and I learned a number of things. So I got into gluten-free baking about 3 years ago when my niece was diagnosed with celiac disease. And it just opened my world about wheat. And there's a whole movement of people that are reducing the amount of wheat they're eating. Some people are wheat intolerant. Some people have actual celiac disease, which for children especially is very dangerous because it affects their digestion and the nutrients they're able to absorb or not absorb, and can really affect their growth and development. Some people have wheat allergies, wheat intolerances, etc. And people are discovering that they feel better not eating wheat or not eating at least as much wheat as they used to before, because as we learn more about food manufacturing, we learn more and more about what is in our foods. And a lot of things are in our foods that we really don't need. Wheat is used for so many different things that you cannot imagine. So when I created my gluten-free honey cake recipe last year, I used rice flour and oat flour. I'm a big fan of oats. I really enjoy them. But there is some concern in the world of gluten and celiac disease about oats. So my understanding originally was the problem with oats was due to the fact that oat fields are frequently in close proximity to wheat fields. And so there's a chance for cross-contamination between the fields, and so there could be some wheat plants that are growing amongst the oat groats. And when the oats are harvested, some wheat can get in there and contaminate the batch, and then they're processed and bagged and sold. And people that can't have even a speck of wheat might get the contamination from eating oats. And lovingly, fortunately, a number of different suppliers responded and started growing pure oats, where their oats were not grown anywhere near wheat fields. And then they did some significant testing and certification to assure that their oats did not contain any wheat contamination, that their oats did not contain any gluten. But there are some that are very sensitive and still cannot consume oats, because there have been studies that have been shown that there's a storage protein in oats called avenin, and it also generates a immune response. So some people that have these gluten intolerances and celiac disease also respond poorly with oats. And so in response, I updated my sweeter than honey cake recipe. You can use oat flour in it, but if you have a problem with oats, you can use sorghum flour. And that's what I love about this planet. You know, more and more of us are eating so many of the same foods all the time. McDonald's likes to use the same variety of potato. We like uniformity. We like things to be the same and taste the same. When we go back to it, we want it to be the same. And yet variety is the spice of life. Variety is the way we are going to survive and create a sustainable world. We need lots of varieties of potatoes, lots of different kinds of varieties of oats, and lots of varieties of all kinds of different foods. And what I like, what I've been learning about gluten-free baking is all the different flours that are out there that I try and have their own unique and special characteristics that can lend themselves in a lovely way to different recipes. I just started working with sorghum flour and, you know, why not? I've mentioned before on this show how I'm in love with garbanzo bean flour, everything that it can do. I use rice flour frequently. And there's so many out there. It's really, really fun. And why not? Variety is the spice of life. And the nice thing is, when you learn that you can't eat one thing, there are lots of other things waiting in line for you to try. This is the world of abundance. And I like to apply that not just to people that might not be able to eat wheat, because they can open up the door and learn about so many other foods that they never were considering before. But also, when you decide to adopt a vegetarian or vegan diet, it is not a diet of deprivation. It is a diet that opens the door. It is a diet that opens your eyes. It's a diet that wakes you up. You're no longer sleepwalking and following the crowd. You're opened up to so many wonderful, healthy, nutritious taste sensations, herbs and spices and beans and grains and vegetables and fruits. It's not just the same soggy white bun, hamburger, ketchup, vanilla thick shake, and fries. No, thank you. It's so, so much more. Well, there you go. It's time to end the show. Thank you for listening. It's been another episode of Ask a Vegan. I'm Karen Hartglass, and please send me an email to info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. That's where you can find me. Ask me questions, anything. Just tell me what you think of the show. Ask me for a recipe. Whatever. I'll do what I can to help. And ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. That's where I live. And I hope you visit often, see some of the videos that we've put up, check out the recipes. Tell me what else you'd like to see. Have a great week.
R-E-A-L.
Responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L,
Reels, good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do.
When it comes to good health,
we need facts that are true, to choose what to eat and save the planet too. That's responsible eating and living.
You'll find the real tools for you.
Real.